Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the things that fascinates me so much about the book is that the Orwells were living, they were married something like 80 years ago, and yet so many of the kinds of things that they're contending with in their political lives, you know, the rise of fascism, the rise of totalitarianism, feel incredibly fresh today. I mean, so I was reading it, I was thinking of Putin, I was thinking of the US presidential elections, I was thinking of so many things that are unfolding in our kind of current moment.
Welcome to our first ever a podcast of one's own book club. Many of you will know I absolutely love to read, and each December for the last few years, I've put out a list of book recommendations. In doing so, I've joked that I'm part of a tiny book club comprising me and my great friend Josephine, who is a huge reader. But I've decided it's time to widen the circle, so I'm really excited to be bringing this new segment to the podcast. As well as our usual interview episodes every month, I'll be sitting down to talk books with one of my fabulous co-hosts. For this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by my friend, the wonderful Sarah Holland Batt. Many of you will remember Sarah from the last season of the podcast. Sarah joined me as a guest after winning the Stella Prize, much deserved, for her incredible book of poetry, The Jaguar. I'm thrilled to be welcoming her back to the pod, this time as co-host. Hello, Sarah.
Look, it's so great to be with you, and I'm really excited to be here as well, in part because I just love sitting around and chatting about books, what a dream, but also because I think book clubs do so much good in the world, and I really, really hope that there are some listeners out there who've been thinking about starting a book club, who have been thinking of joining a book club, who might be inspired through this to take that step, because there's nothing more fun than sitting around and talking about books, particularly books by women, about women, by Australian writers. And I hope that people can read along with the books that we choose if they want to as well. So thanks so much for having me. And it's so great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And yes, the fun of book clubs. And we're starting this one with our very first book. And this month it's Wifedom by Anna Funder. Wifedom tells the untold story of Eileen O'Shaughnessy and her marriage to George Orwell, one of the most famed English authors of all time. It's based on real-life events using recently discovered letters from Eileen to her best friend. Funder recreates the Orwells' marriage, taking readers through the Spanish Civil War and the Second World War in London. Eileen's story has been largely ignored by the history books, and as Funder shows, sometimes even rewritten by biographers of Orwell. Described as, and I'm quoting, an ode to the unsung work of women everywhere, the book questions what it means to be a writer and what it means to be a wife. Sarah, is Anna Funder a name known to you? Have you read her earlier works?
I have read her earlier work. So Anna Funder's an Australian author. She lives in Sydney, and she originally trained as an international human rights lawyer. And you can see those interests kind of playing through her books. Her first book was a work of nonfiction called Stasiland, which looked at the regime in the former East Germany. She followed that up with a Miles Franklin award-winning novel, All That I Am, which I'm sure many people are familiar with. That was a smash hit internationally. And that looked at a group of friends who fled Nazi Germany and found refuge in London. And it included a fictionalised representation of the left-wing revolutionary German playwright Ernst Toller. So Funder has a real interest in literary figures and in reimagining literary figures in interesting ways. And she's also the author of the novella The Girl with the Dogs. And I think if I were to say anything about her books collectively, it's that she has this really strong interest in the rise of totalitarianism in all of its guises, and the revolutionaries and the writers and thinkers who resist and lead the fight against it. But she, as you say, she brings this sort of novelist's inventiveness to the work of history, and that's one of the really interesting things that plays through in Wifedom, because it's sort of a biography But it also has kind of fictional elements as well.
Yeah, it's really very interesting in its form. And I'd have to say I was a bit taken aback by the form when I started it. It's in a very different format than what I was expecting. I was more expecting it to be a work of historical fiction, you know, in novel form where the history underpinning it is right, but someone's imagined their way into the character, you know, Hilary Mantel with her Cromwell series, for example. But it's quite different than that. It's a mix of just absolutely straight nonfiction. She's quoting from letters from Eileen and others written at the time. So history as you would get it in a history course, straight from the sources. And then it also weaves in her imaginings of Eileen in scenes in her life, her inner monologue. So a novel, as you would imagine a novel. And then Anna drops into her own voice. Sometimes we're actually in her life with her family in Sydney. So it's really this interplay of the three parts. How did you find that?
Yeah, look, it's really fascinating. And I think she's sort of expanding biography as a genre. Because like you say, we think of biography as just facts. We're used to reading letters. We're used to kind of finding out a story basically through piecing the documents that people leave behind. But of course, we're all so much more than the documents we leave behind. And that's the sort of frustration sometimes reading biographies, is that you get a huge sense of where people were and what they did. But bringing out the character can be, I think, a little bit more elusive. And so I love that she speculated, and I think that's probably the right word, because we don't really know what Eileen thought or believed about any of this. We know that obviously she found Orwell hugely compelling as a husband and as an intellectual kind of figure in her life. But there's all these gaps because a lot of the correspondence doesn't survive. And so it's sort of in those gaps that Funda finds space, I think, to reimagine Eileen. But I was really, really interested that not only does she do that, so it is kind of hybrid work, but she also brings herself into the frame, like you say. And we have these sort of passages set in the present, set against the sort of context of Me Too, set against the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, all these kind of contemporary events sort of playing out against the backdrop of a marriage that unfolded 80 years ago. And it's interesting, isn't it? It sort of invites us to look at the correspondences and the changes between those time periods. Did you find yourself thinking about the way in which the past and the present were speaking to each other in the book?
Yeah, I did. And I actually think probably my favourite line in the book, and it's a line that's familiar to all of us from driving cars. She says at one point, "Things in the rearview mirror are closer than they appear." And of course, we see that we see that every day. But she's using it in this very beautiful way to say, you know, the past is actually just sitting on our shoulder and it's whispering in our ear. And no matter how you are trying to construct your relationship in the modern age, and she's reflecting on her own status as a wife, whispering in your ear is all of this history and burden of what marriage is and what wifedom is. I thought that was really cleverly done.
And that question of what a wife's role is, I think, is really fascinating too, because Eileen in some ways is such an unconventional wife. She's a very strange wife. They have a very, very strange marriage. I mean, I don't know many people who opt to live in a sort of punitive cottage with no running water, with no electricity, with you know, very little heat, and then go off to fight the Spanish Civil War together. They do these sort of crazy adventures as a kind of couple, but also separately. And I was intrigued at how separate their marriage was at times. I mean, they were only married for 9 years before Eileen died. So it seems like this sort of dramatic historical experience that they have together. And yet it's quite short. And yet during that time, they're both coming and going, doing different work in different places, leading slightly independent lives. So in some ways, it's quite conventional as a marriage, in that she does a lot of the sort of roles that we would think of as female roles, as a wife's role to support her husband. But in other ways, and weirder and more interesting ways, she's sort of quite adventurous, risk-taking, independent, spirited. What was your sort of take on Eileen that sort of came through the book? I mean, did you warm to her as a sort of character? She's so fascinating as a figure, isn't she?
She is fascinating as a figure. I did warm to her, but there were times she frustrated me too. I mean, just to set the historical sort of context here, we're talking about a woman, Eileen, who was born in 1905 and she died in 1945. So a short life. She died at the age of 39 and she married George Orwell in 1936. So relatively short marriage because she did not live long. And there is, to both of them, this intriguing devil-may-care kind of approach to life. One of the characters in the book, and this is actually based on the historical record, talked of them as reckless about their own lives, you know, talked in the Blitz in London when bombs are raining down in the sky in World War II and everybody is running to the underground station or some other form of shelter. They would just stay in their apartment on the top floor and kind of watch the sound and light show as the bombs fell. So this, you know, huge recklessness about their own lives, going to the Spanish Civil War. Ultimately, the way in which Eileen dies, she needs an operation. She is very physically run down. She's advised that she needs a series of blood transfusions to build her up before the operation. But she doesn't do that. She instead goes through the cheaper course of just having the operation straight up without the blood transfusions, and she doesn't survive it. So there is this, you know, recklessness, and yet there are times when you think she could have been more independent of action in her marriage. And then you double think that George Orwell word, double think, we wouldn't have that word if it wasn't for George Orwell. You double think it and you think, I'm seeing that, the capacity for her to escape some of the negative aspects of this marriage through my eyes, but maybe they did not present themselves through her eyes, given she lived in, you know, and the marriage was in the 1930s and 1940s.
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, that question of agency? And because she expressed so much agency in her life, she did so many incredibly brave, frankly, kind of crazy things. The stuff she was doing when George Orwell decided he wanted to fight in the Spanish Civil War, and she followed him, and he was on the front, once again taking huge risks. One of the funniest kind of running themes in the book is that he was really tall, yet refused to duck while the bullets were kind of whizzing at him over the top of the trench. I mean, so while he's doing that, he leaves her behind in England, but she decides then to follow him, and she goes and works in this office kind of leading a sort of resistance movement against fascism while also surrounded by sort of Stalin's spies. So there were sort of enemies from the left and from the right surrounding her. She didn't even have her husband with her, and she was basically kind of running the entire operation of the office. She was doing supplies, medicine, banking for all of the kind of agents who were working on, you know, in their grouping of resistance. And I find it really fascinating that she had all this agency to do these incredibly heroic or perhaps even fatalistically dangerous things, and yet stayed with a man. And probably we need to talk a little bit about, I suppose, the ambivalence that we both feel about her decision to stay in that marriage, because in a way, wifedom invites us to speculate about why. Obviously, Orwell was so brilliant and such a genius, and I love his work, I love his novels, I love his thought. Like you say, it lives with us today in our language, and yet he was a kind of terrible human being to his wife. And really, it's that his sexual politics is his one kind of fatal flaw, isn't it?
It is. And let's come to Orwell and the man and the art just in a minute. But to paint the picture of the marriage, so here's this vivacious, daredevil kind of woman, yet the marriage is characterised by unceasing domestic drudgery. She's expected to tolerate Orwell's philandering, but she is required to be faithful to him. She wants to have a child. He's not capable of fathering a child. You know, the idea is raised that she could have an affair, which would lead to her being able to have a child, and that's just a no-no from Orwell's point of view. And yet he is frequently in sexual escapades outside the marriage. When he writes about his own life, about his time in the Spanish Civil War, he writes her out. She's not even present. Reading his own accounts of that time, you wouldn't even realise that his wife was there. And he made no acknowledgement of her contribution to his writing in general. And, you know, Funda paints this. Admittedly, some of these things are acts of imagination, but she paints this very, very sharply. To give one example of it, which really very much caught my eye, I think it's going to catch everybody's eye who reads this book. She writes that as Eileen is literally up to her elbows in shit as she is trying to fix their outhouse toilet, Orwell calls out of the window of his study, "Tea time, don't you think?" And Funda writes of Eileen, "Her blood was ice. Not for a split second has she thought that he meant he'd make it for her." In the sort of fictional bit, but we do know from sources like Richard Rees, who's a lifetime friend of Orwell's, who in a letter that survives does say about Orwell that he had an exaggerated sense of honour, and that explains his ruthlessness towards himself and perhaps also his occasional inconsiderateness towards others. And yet it would not be easy to think of many victims of his inconsiderateness apart from his wife. So we do have a friend of Orwell's who's obviously looked at this marriage and thought it's not fair to the wife. We've got these sharply imagined scenes from Anna Funda, yet she stays.
She does stay. And I mean, it's not just that he was philandering. You know, there's kind of scenes in there where he basically, the word that biographers seem to favour is pounces on women, which I suppose in contemporary parlance we might say attacks, or, you know, there's scenes of Orwell coming onto women and women having to effectively fight him off. And so I think the question of just how bad his sexual behaviour is one that Funda really kind of draws to the fore and invites us to kind of contemplate. And yet you have Eileen who's, like I said, so spirited, so independent, knows her own mind. She's also incredibly funny in the letters. You know, you get a real sense of this sort of woman who really wouldn't take Orwell's shit. You know, when he's saying to her, you know, "I want to sleep with a prostitute," there's kind of instances of her pushing back, but there must have been some lure that kept her in that marriage. And you can speculate about what that might be. I tend to think that she recognised in him an intellectual equal and someone who just set her mind alight. You know, there's some really beautiful scenes when he was writing Animal Farm, and they would sit in bed of an evening and he'd tell her about what he'd written and read to her the day's work, and she'd talk to him about it. And you can imagine the excitement of living in a marriage like that, where you have this intellect, this mind kind of sharing this amazing work with you. And yet it's so hard, I think, for us to look at a man behaving that poorly in so many ways. From before he met Eileen, even when he met Eileen, he had something like three other girlfriends on the go. Across his life, he was still constantly trying to seduce this woman, Brenda, who was a school teacher he'd taught with before he met Eileen. And she had no interest in him, and he never really stopped trying to seduce her. There was a kind of strange compulsion there that's very hard to reconcile. And yet I wonder whether Eileen would share this view of Orwell, because obviously there was enough that kept her in that marriage that made her want to stay.
Yeah, and the letters do speak of a love, and the recorded historical events do too. I mean, when Orwell is wounded at the front in the Spanish Civil War, and he doesn't think he's going to make it because the wound is actually in his neck. He's recorded as saying, "Tell Eileen I love her," in what he may well have in his mind thought was going to be his dying declaration. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot there, but yes, with our eyes, certainly his conduct is objectionable. I think Funda tries to get to what is explaining Eileen's conduct in a passage that I read over a few times because I thought it was a beautifully phrased way of trying to get to the question as to how women end up settling into their own oppression. And it is when Eileen is thinking about Orwell and how he's unfaithful, and Funda writes, "Eileen wonders if it's the sex with them," meaning the others outside the marriage, "that makes him feel powerful, or if her humiliation does the trick. The only way she can manage not to be humiliated is to pretend it doesn't matter. And to do that is to pretend that she does not matter." And whether Funda is trying to signpost that you get to a stage where you think you don't matter. And maybe that then comes through in Eileen's final letter to Orwell. She writes a letter immediately before the operation which kills her, which he does not get until after she is dead. And in the letter, she talks about thinking, and these are the words, "What worries me is I really don't think I'm worth the money to spend on the better operation, the transfusions, the things that would give her more chance of surviving."
I mean, it would wear you down, wouldn't it? Orwell's overseas, she's hemorrhaging effectively to death, and she's been told over and over in her marriage that in some fundamental way, she's not enough. Sexually, she's not enough. His appetites are larger than what she's able to bring. It's hard not to imagine that that would take a huge dent on someone's psyche. And yet she's so stoic, isn't she? She sort of bears all of that with incredible grace and dignity and independence. And in a way, I find that last letter fascinating for so many reasons, because she refused to have Orwell telephoned. She insisted on just writing a letter and the letter would arrive in good time. And so there are these sort of little moments of defiance and independence from what you would think of as a totally dependent kind of marriage. It's not a codependent marriage in that way. They're very kind of separate individuals in these key points in their lives. But it's really, really hard to imagine that on some level, no matter how stoic you are, no matter how laissez-faire your attitude is towards sex, no matter how open you are in your marriage, that one partner seeking constantly something outside of it wouldn't take a huge toll.
I think that's right. And I think it is, you know, taking the layers back and asking us to think about that and to think about the echoes of that in the modern age. I mean, so many things have changed, but I think Funda is also asking us to think about the things that remain the same. One thing in the book that, you know, we'll never know the absolute truth of because the historical record doesn't allow us to, but which Funda clearly raises, is the dimensions of Eileen's contribution to Orwell's writing. And, you know, I mean, Orwell was a prolific author. He wrote many things, but most people would remember the sort of masterpieces, the two masterpieces, 1984, which is the story of a dystopian totalitarian regime where Big Brother is always watching you, of course, giving birth in the modern age to that reality TV show Big Brother, which does not show any of the elegance or wit of 1984, let it be said. The other, I mean, absolutely, you know, seminal work for George Orwell is Animal Farm, which at one level is you know, written like a kid's story, like a fable. You know, there's talking horses and talking pigs and all the rest of it. You know, we obviously associate talking animals with fables and kids' stories, but it is using that mechanism to parody Stalinism and communism and the oppression of human liberty. And Funda passes out in this that Eileen, before she was married, wrote an essay entitled 1984, and it was Eileen who loved fables and those sorts of that kind of writing style, and had talked to Orwell about it when he was thinking of a more direct essay or book on Stalinism. So, I mean, there's just these wonderful teasing little bits, and we'll never know the answer about how much she really was involved in the production of these books that have shaped the language we use and the way we think about human liberty and its oppression.
I mean, she was clearly his sounding board, and so through conversation with Eileen, I think so much of his thinking would have evolved naturally, as it does with the person that you're closest to. He was someone who talked about his work. There is, you know, documentation of them having conversations as he was writing Animal Farm and so forth. Interestingly, it was a poem, not an essay, that she wrote called 1984, in which I believe she envisages a future in which children are educated through sort of a television, some form of sort of kind of communication that's not unlike, I suppose, what you end up seeing in Orwell's novel. The great tragedy for me, I think, when I think about that question of contribution, and it's one that we're weighing up with so many writers. You know, there've been recent books on people like Zelda Fitzgerald, F. Scott Fitzgerald's wife, Nora Joyce, James Joyce's wife. It's sort of a question that I think is fundamentally unknowable, just what the scope of that is. But I think in Eileen's case, the great tragedy for me is that she never lived to see his success, and she died just around the time that Animal Farm was being published. And, you know, that was her idea, that was her suggestion to him, that he write it in the form of a fable. And really, that was the text that then vaulted him into being the George Orwell that we know. And 1984, as we know, that was published just before he died too. So neither of them really, I mean, it's kind of quite extraordinary to think of their ages. She was 39 when she died. He was 46, I think it is, when he died. Yeah, 46 when he died. And yet look at the sort of intellectual legacy that they both left. And yet neither of them, Orwell lived to see some of his success and the success of 1984 beginning. But I think neither of them could have known. There's a poignancy to that for me, just how influential those ideas and those texts would remain. I mean, I read recently that in the UK, Animal Farm was voted as the nation's favourite text that they study in high school. Those are, you know, English teenagers in 2024's favourite school text is still, you know, Animal Farm. It's amazing to think of how prescient those ideas were and how kind of current they are today still.
I am loving it that the poet on the podcast has corrected me that, yes, Eileen, 1984, the title was to a poem. Of course, you would remember that.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Obviously, all of this examination of Orwell by looking at the marriage and looking at it through Eileen's eyes, it does raise the question that we're debating very frequently in the modern age. You know, can you separate the artist from the art if the artist is a fundamentally flawed human being? And you know, even putting aside the fictional narrative in this book, there's enough in the recorded history for us to look at Orwell quite differently than perhaps we would have. That question to me was curiously unexamined by Funder in this book. She does a very short sentence at one point. She says, "To my mind, a person is not their work, just where it came from. To want the two to be the same on pain of cancellation is a new kind of tyranny, and from there no art comes." But that's the only thing she says about it. And if you stand back from it, you would have said Anna Funder is a, you know, George Orwell kind of person, in the sense that, you know, Orwell's life's works were all about exposing totalitarianism, tyranny, the misuse of power. And her books, Stasi Land, All That I Am, have been about exposing tyranny, subjugation and the misuse of power. So you would have thought before she started on this book, she was probably, heavens above, I love George Orwell. And I think many people listening to this podcast are like, don't tell me I have to cancel George. I bloody love George Orwell. You know, where are we on that? And did you think it was weirdly unexamined too?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think George Orwell is probably uncancellable at this point. His influence is so pervasive. You know, we're never not going to be thinking and talking about 1984. It's just one of those books. So is Animal Farm. I think he's probably safe from cancellation. And I tend to agree with Funder in that I think both of these things can coexist. A book like Wifedom can coexist with the works of George Orwell. That's what books are all about. If you don't like a book, if you don't like a figure, you're welcome to enter that conversation. And I think anything that chills that conversation is sort of a problem, because we want literature to be kind of open. We want people to have these conversations. So on the subject of whether I thought she was sort of silent about what we do with Orwell's legacy, I think that's kind of the question ultimately that the book is sort of posing to the reader. And Funder is, she makes the point that there are all these other biographies that lionize Orwell into the mythical kind of figure that he is today. I mean, he's such a sort of towering figure. And this is a sort of, she calls it a counterfiction, which, you know, I tend to think almost like a counterpunch. You know, there's all of these cases for Orwell, and then here's a case kind of for Eileen. And maybe that's the way we negotiate these conversations going forward, because I tend to think that cancelling someone and, you know, censoring his books because we don't like how he behaved in his public, you know, private life, is just as bad as cancelling a book because we don't like its depiction of, I don't know, religion or sex or any other of the sort of subjects that people can be offended by. So it's sort of, it's a challenging one, isn't it? And I think Funder just leaves it open for the reader to make up their own mind about, which is maybe the most sensible approach. I mean, here we are thinking about it. I'm sure everyone who's listening, who's thinking of reading the book, will be curious to make up their own mind. And I think it's just something that as an individual reader, you've just got to come to your own position on how you feel about a writer and how you feel about their work can be two very distinct, sometimes very contradictory ideas that we can hold hopefully at the same time.
I think that's very well said, absolutely. In it, particularly when she's in her own voice, she does deliver some wonderful, very quotable lines about patriarchy. Let me just quote one. She's deliberately used the term doublethink, which we wouldn't have if George Orwell hadn't written 1984. She writes, "Patriarchy is the doublethink that allows an apparently decent man to behave badly to women, in the same way as colonialism and racism are the systems that allow apparently decent people to do unspeakable things to other people. In order for men to do their deeds and be innocent of them at the same time, women must be human, but not fully so, or a sense of falsity and hence of guilt would set in."
Absolutely. And I mean, the phrase that she used that I totally loved and intend to kind of carry in my personal life is she talks about male pattern blindness, which I just think is so funny. But that is kind of what we see in Orwell, isn't it? Because here's this great champion of human decency, of human dignity, of the dignity of the individual. You know, here's someone who in a way has dedicated his life to the underdog and to fighting tyranny. And yet there is this little patch of blindness in him that allows him to sort of behave in ways that he's conditioned to through the patriarchy, and to think of women, you know, in this very transactional way where he's, you know, concerned with the dignity and the decency of the human being everywhere else in his life. And yet he has this kind of little, well, not little, this quite major flaw in his thinking. And she writes really wonderfully, I think, about the ironies of Orwell's thinking, and invites us. I think that's the thing I like about the book, is ultimately she doesn't sort of try and say, well, and this is where we need to land on Orwell. She presents everything from her perspective, which is on Eileen, very firmly in Eileen's corner. But I like that there's no sort of broader push to say, and for these reasons, we really need to completely rethink the way that we view Orwell's fiction or his general contribution.
Who do you think will really enjoy reading this book? I mean, you know, you'd need, I mean, different times of your life, different moods, you're in the mind for a different book. You know, who do you think will particularly like this book? What mood would you need to be in to go, right, I'm absolutely running down to the shop or hitting the Kindle button or whatever to read Wifedom?
I mean, one of the things that fascinates me so much about the book is, again, that, you know, the Orwells were living, they were married something like 80 years ago, and yet so many of the kinds of things that they're contending with in their political lives, you know, the rise of fascism, the rise of totalitarianism, feel incredibly fresh today. I mean, so for me, I was reading it, I was thinking of Putin, I was thinking of the US presidential elections, I was thinking of so many things that are unfolding in our kind of current moment, and how history kind of repeats or rhymes across that kind of distance. So I think it's for anyone who's interested in Orwell, that sort of goes without saying, anyone who loves his books, this will not put you off Orwell. This will make you more interested in Orwell. It might make you pick up another biography. But it's also, I think, for anyone who's kind of interested in the politics of our time, because even though this is a text that's mostly set in the 30s and 40s with the rise of fascism in Europe, it feels surprisingly fresh and current to me. So I think basically it's a book for anyone interested in history or kind of geopolitics today. What, how about you, Julia? Were you thinking of a particular type of reader who might be drawn to this?
Yeah, I think you're right to point to the way it is chiming with current events. That's absolutely true. I do wonder whether some people will pick it up thinking what I must admit I originally thought, that it would be your more classic historical fiction and you could settle in with a, you know, a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and read a book that unfurls over time. I mean, you know, Kate Grenville writes wonderful historical fiction. I mean, Hilary Mantel, the masterclass with her Cromwell series. You know, you can pick up a Kate Moss, that's not the supermodel, that's the author, and lose yourself in that kind of historical fiction. I think some people will pick it up expecting that, and it's good to know it's not that. So I think you possibly need to be in not that relaxed, like a warm bath, historical fiction read. It is more challenging than that, but it does repay it being a bit more challenging than that. And some people, I think, will be frustrated that it doesn't have the conclusion. I completely get what you say about the way she's written it. Anna Funder is sort of begging us to go away thinking about these questions. But I think that there will be people who close the last page who say, oh, but I don't know, you know, I still don't know. Like, I wanted to end up knowing. So, you know, if you've ever read a novel where they don't solve the murder mystery and it's just driven you to absolute distraction, this may not be the book for you. It has inspired me, though. Anna refers in Wifedom to Parallel Lives by Phyllis Rose, and she inspired me to read that, and that's the recounting of five Victorian marriages and trying to get you to see, you know, both sides of them. So I thought that was an intriguing follow-on read. And for anybody who's wondering who comes out best, the winner is undoubtedly George Eliot, who, as we know, was not George Eliot, was Mary Ann Evans, who in that age lived with the love of her life and never married him. And then after he died, married a man 20 years younger than her. So she comes out the winner, but the other wives in that book do not come out quite so in front.
Oh, well, good for George Eliot.
Yes, good for George Eliot, Middlemarch, and the inside story of her marriages, or one of them not being a marriage. Anything else you wanted to say on Wifedom? What are you reading, or did it inspire you to read anything as a follow-on? There is, of course, we're on a bit of a George Orwell fest, aren't we? Because I think it was last year a book called Julia came out, which is a reimagining of 1984 from the perspective of the female protagonist. That's by Sandra Newman. I haven't read that one, but that could be a follow-on read.
I think so. And I think, I mean, one of the things this book did was it sent me back to Orwell. So I revisited 1984, I revisited Animal Farm, just, you know, luxuriating in them. But I'm also really curious, Anna Funder mentions that in 2020 there was a biography, just a straight biography written of Eileen by a scholar called Sylvia Topp. And so I've ordered that. It hasn't arrived yet, but I think that could be a really interesting follow-on read for me. I'm fascinated to see the differences, I think, because we know very firmly what Funder's interpretations are. And so I'm curious, because I think there are some interesting gaps in the way that they see Eileen. So that could be a follow-on for people who really want to go down the Orwell marriage rabbit hole.
I can see this becoming a whole subgenre. Everything about Orwell always sticks with me because of the names. I remember reading 1984 as a teenager, and spoiler alert, the pivotal end scene is when the hero, I suppose one would say, the central male character, Winston, is being tortured with rats. And he ends up crying out to his torturer, "Do it to Julia," who is his love interest in the book. So that was a shattering experience for me reading that when I was a teenager. Absolutely shattering. And my middle name is Eileen, so all sorts of connections here.
That's amazing.
Yeah, a lot of identification with things with Eileen in Wifedom, and I'm definitely reading the Sandra Newman Julia book to find out how I would have seen it all if I was there. Well, Sarah, this has been huge fun. Thank you for joining me on the start of this book club adventure for our first ever book club. And to everyone listening, we're really keen for you to get involved with the conversation. So if you don't already, make sure you follow us at Instagram at A Podcast of One's Own. That way you can join the discussion, share your thoughts on this book, tell us if you agree with us, disagree with us, and importantly, give us good ideas and suggestions for what books we should be reading next. And we're really looking forward to seeing you next time. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Julia.
A Podcast of One's Own is created by the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at the Australian National University, Canberra, with support from our sister institute at King's College, London. Earnings from the podcast go back into funding for the institute, which was founded by our host, Julia Gillard, and brings together rigorous research, practice and advocacy as a powerful force to advance gender equality and promote fair and equal access to leadership. Research and production for this podcast is by Becca Shepherd, Alice Higgins and Alina Ecott, with editing by Liz Keane from Headline Productions. If you have feedback or ideas, please email us at giwl@anu.edu.au. To stay up to date with the Institute's work, go to giwl.anu.edu.au and sign up to our updates or follow us on social media at JewelANU. You can also find A Podcast of One's Own on Instagram. The team at A Podcast of One's Own acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.